Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 519 for January 31st, 2015. Coming up in a few minutes.
We had to remortgage the house, right? For the 3 years of best practices research that I did, that was all unsalaried, right? Year and a half of financing that I put into it, it was all unsalaried. We've racked up our mortgage big time, right? So it's a classic entrepreneurial story. There's a lot on the table here.
Graham McAloney gave up a safe career in the pharmaceutical industry to pursue his dream of making whiskey. He's signed on two experts to help him make Victoria Caledonian Distillery a reality, Dr. Jim Swan, and longtime Diageo Distillery manager Mike Nicholson. He'll share his story with us later on Whiskey Cast In Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, this week's Your Voice, and much more, all on this week's Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com.
Let's get started with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Jimmy Russell isn't going anywhere, but the longtime Wild Turkey master distiller has decided that 34 years of apprenticeship was long enough for his son Eddie. This week, he took the word associate off of Eddie's title, making them the latest father and son team of master distillers in Kentucky. Eddie Russell has been in Brazil this week doing promotional work for Wild Turkey, but we talked by phone for a few minutes. He told me Jimmy wanted to make the move last year, but was talked out of it so that it wouldn't overshadow his 60th anniversary celebrations.
From the time when I went there for a summer job 34 years ago, within a few weeks I realized, you know, that this was the place for me in Wild Turkey. And, you know, shortly after that, you know, I went to Jimmy and I said, you know, one day I'd love to be, you know, following your footsteps. Because I've been around not only Jimmy, but Bucano and Elmer Tilley, and had so much respect for all those guys and the knowledge that they had. And, you know, back then my dad was not only master distiller, but he was plant manager and human resources and everything. And he sort of said, well, which part? And I said, well, I only want to be the master distiller part. I want to make the whiskey and take care of the whiskey and things like that. So that's really, you know, even back then, 34 years ago, I realized that, you know, I wanted to follow in his footsteps and follow in the footsteps of not only him, but all the great master distillers.
And he made you start at the bottom too, right?
Oh, yeah, he started me at the bottom person on the pole in the union. So I rode barrels, got bottles, got cases, just anything that anybody else didn't want to do. And, you know, that's how he learned, and that's the best way to learn. For me, you know, if you look at Jimmy and Booker and all those guys, they knew everything about it, not just making the whiskey, but how to age the whiskey, you know. My dad even went to balling every day to make sure the packages looked right. And to me, that's what a master distiller is about. So, you know, over the years, just being, I mean, I've been in every department there, even worked in maintenance for a while, just to, you know, to make sure I knew where all the popping was and different things like that.
While Jimmy Russell hinted at a couple of new releases in an email sent to members of the Russell's Reserve Legacy Society, Eddie gave us more than just hints. Look for a Russell's Reserve Single Barrel Rye Whiskey later this year, along with a 17-year-old Wild Turkey Bourbon. That would be the oldest Wild Turkey release ever, since Jimmy Russell has refused to release anything older than 15 years.
Jimmy didn't really like Boulder whiskeys, but I've really worked with it and moved it around. It's had a pretty good journey to make sure it doesn't get too oaky and too woody, which is his concerns about older whiskey. So it's going to be some pretty neat things, I think, that will appeal to the people that are growing our industry, which is younger people and bartenders, mixologists. So, yeah, I'm working on quite a few things, and the ones with some kind of out where I'm not real happy with them, so I just put them aside. And some, these two are two that I think are really going to be great as they come out.
By the way, the Russell family's next generation has just started on the path. Eddie's son Bruce joined Wild Turkey this month after graduating from the University of Kentucky in December. Unlike his father, he will not start out rolling barrels yet. Bruce Russell's first job will be as a brand ambassador for Wild Turkey in Texas, and he'll return to Kentucky in a couple of years to start training at the distillery. You can hear my entire interview with Eddie Russell in the news section at WhiskeyCast.com. Wild Turkey and nearby Four Roses have been two of the biggest beneficiaries of the boom in bourbon-related tourism. Both distilleries have had increases in visitor traffic of 200% plus over the last 5 years, and that's helped contribute to another record year along the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. The Kentucky Distillers Association reports more than 723,000 people visited the 18 distilleries along the Bourbon Trail and the Bourbon Trail's Craft Tour during 2014. The Craft Tour features 9 of Kentucky's craft distilleries. It had a 56% increase in traffic during its second full year. Tourism is just one part of whiskey's economic impact, and a new study released this week by the Scotch Whiskey Association puts the industry's overall impact on the UK economy at around £5 billion, or about $7.5 billion a year. The study by the research firm Four Consulting found each job in the industry supports almost 3 additional jobs in support sectors, such as transportation, packaging, and tourism. The Scotch Whiskey Association's David Williamson told me this week they knew they had a big economic footprint before the study, but some of the findings surprised them.
What was particularly surprising was just the how much value is added to the economy. So, for example, Scotch whiskey has a bigger economic value now to the UK economy than industries like shipbuilding or computers. It's not as big as car manufacturing, but a third as big. And you know, these are chunky numbers that have been revealed by the report. And I think you really start to see how Scotch whiskey is benchmarked across to other industries. It's a very traditional industry in many ways, but also a modern manufacturing sector, supporting a lot of jobs, over 40,000 across the country. And I think that's really been one of the telling features of the report's conclusions.
The SWA and other spirits industry leaders are pushing for a 2% cut in UK spirits taxes when Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne releases the government's next budget March 18th. Williamson says economists believe that cut would generate an additional £1.5 billion a year in economic impact. The entire interview with David Williamson and the SWA's complete report are available at WhiskeyCast.com. Whiskey Magazine has announced the third and final round of Regional Icons of Whiskey Award winners for 2015. This round covers the rest of the world, other than Scotland and the U.S. Those winners were announced in the first two rounds. South Africa's Distel was named Distiller of the Year, while Ian Chang of Taiwan's King Car Distillery was named Distillery Manager of the Year. King Car makes Cavalan single malts, and the distillery was also named Brand Innovator of the Year. A complete list of winners is available at our website. Winners from all three rounds will go up against each other in voting for the Global Icons of Whiskey Awards to be presented in London March 19th. One final business note, Diageo blamed slumping sales for an 18% drop in earnings per share during the first half of the fiscal year. Overall sales fell in every region worldwide except for Africa. That includes the U.S., where Johnnie Walker sales were off by 14%. CEO Ivan Menezes acknowledged in a conference call after the report that the company pushed U.S. price increases for some of its brands too far, but said price cuts are not in the forecast. One bright spot, while European sales were off slightly overall, the U.K., France, Italy, and Turkey all reported increased sales during the period. New whiskeys to mention this time around. Annock is releasing the oldest bottling from Knock Doo Distillery yet. The Annock 1975 vintage comes from 4X sherry casks, with about 1,600 bottles to be available worldwide. The price will be around £300 or $450 a bottle. Glendronach is releasing its latest batch of single cask bottlings. Nine different expressions ranging from 18 to 43 years old make up the 11th batch of single casks. The oldest comes from a sherry puncheon filled back in 1971. It'll carry a recommended retail price of £860, or about $1,300 a bottle. The youngest is a 1996 Oloroso sherry butt. It'll sell for a recommended retail price of £93, or about $140 per bottle. All nine come from ex-sherry casks. One other Glendronach single cask to mention, the folks at the Green Welly stop in Tindrum, Scotland are celebrating their 50th anniversary this year. They've arranged to get a cask of Glendronach filled back in 2003, bottled for sale exclusively through the shop. 649 bottles will be available at a price of £50, or about $75 a bottle. Now, this should come as no surprise, but it turns out that many Scots would like to share a dram with one of the most famous Scots around. The Spirit of Speyside Festival commissioned a poll of 2,000 Scots on whiskey, and one question asked whom they would most like to raise a glass with. 22% said Sir Sean Connery, making him the leading Scot. However, he did come in behind the late Winston Churchill, who passed away 50 years ago this week. And finally, if you're visiting the Vatican, it might just be worth taking a flask along with you. Daniel and Jen Adams of Dundee, Scotland, were honeymooning in Rome this week and had made arrangements ahead of time to receive a blessing from the Pope. Of course, Daniel wore a traditional Highland formal for the audience with Pope Francis, including a kilt and sporran. But he was shocked when the Pope asked if he had any whiskey in the sporran. He didn't, but they both still got a blessing and a hug from the Pope. You can keep up with the latest whiskey news all week long at whiskeycast.com. The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie.
You can make perfectly good whiskey in shorter stills. For a purer whiskey, we made ours the tallest in Scotland. Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well made.
Just a reminder, we're still trying to raise money for the Spey Foundation, which works with the Spey Fishery Board to protect and restore fish and wildlife habitat along the River Spey in Scotland. The River Spey at Sunset charity print is available only through the WhiskeyCast website. Each 16x20-inch print is $50 plus $10 for shipping, and a portion of the price of each print will go to the Spey Foundation. You can see the print and get more details at WhiskeyCast.com. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker. You may remember the story last time around about the anatomical whiskey tasting planned for Valentine's Day in London, in which participants will sample drams from various body parts of male and female models, matching the ages of the whiskies. John Birkbeck of the South Wales Whiskey Interest Group posted this on our Facebook page, quoting now, "Okay, I've gone back and listened again just to make sure I heard that right, and just to make sure it's not April 1st. The Ace Hotel wants me to drink whiskey off of someone? Did they forget to order the glasses in time or something? I give them top marks for originality, but for now I think I'll stick with the humble Glencairn at our tastings." Same here, John. Personally, I'd kind of like to get that image out of my mind. Bob LeCan, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, of Cleveland, posted a question on our Facebook page the other day. "Just saw a bottle of Maker's Mark with yellow over the red wax. Nobody seems to know the meaning. Any help?" Well, I had a feeling it might have something to do with sports, and after checking with the folks at Maker's Mark, have confirmed that the colors are very similar to those of a certain Cleveland sports team. But since Maker's Mark is not an official sponsor of that team, I won't mention the name of the team here. Passed that on to Bob, who admitted that he's not a sports fan. Now, Claudio Arado, who's on Twitter at Pengdio, P-E-N-G-D-I-O, passed along a link to an interesting infographic the other day that shows the extent of consolidation in the whiskey business. If you're following me on Twitter at WhiskeyCast, take a look at his post and the graphic. And if you have anything you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, you can always post it on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and even Pinterest at WhiskeyCast. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. February is shaping up to be a busy month around the world. Whiskey Live Belgium kicks things off this coming weekend in Spa, along with the Linköping's Whiskey Expo in Sweden and Hansa Spirit 2015 in Hamburg, Germany. Woodford Reserve will offer its annual Valentine's Dinner and Tour the evenings of February 12th through the 14th at the distillery in Versailles, Kentucky. The Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's UK chapter has a Valentine's Day champagne and whiskey tasting on the 14th in Edinburgh, and Texas on the Rocks is that same night in Austin, Texas. The Bourbon Classic is coming up in Louisville on February 20th and 21st. Whiskey Live New York is several weeks earlier than usual this year. It's at Chelsea Piers on the 25th. And the annual Julio's Go Whiskey Weekend is the final weekend of the month at Julio's Liquors in Westboro, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. Those are just a few of the 279 different events on the searchable calendar at WhiskeyCast.com. The calendar is brought to you by Laphroaig. Share your opinions on Laphroaig's uniquely complex whiskeys at laphroaig.com/opinions or on social media with the hashtag #OpinionsWelcome.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Michael Power, stock controller, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
I've been working in Middleton Distillery for the last 28 years. My job base is to organise deliveries of the cereals that are used to make Redbreast. Also, I have to be very mindful of the quality of the cereals coming in, such as the barley and the malt, which are specifically used for Redbreast. We're very mindful of the continuity of supply and the continuity of quality, and we use grain suppliers from the Munster area, which is one of the best growing areas for barley in Ireland. I have been dealing with basically the same people, such as Henry Goods and Pat Den, who have been supplying us with barley. It's usually spring barley going back all those years. Over the years, I've grown to like Redbreast more and more. It's because it's like the distillery itself. Something has developed with me. When you've tasted other whiskies, you learn to drink whiskey, and then later on, when you want more complexity or you want something more from a whiskey, tend to go to whiskies like Redbreast. Redbreast is unique because of the way it's made. In the traditional way, the pot stills would have been the traditional way to make Irish whiskey.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Maker's Mark. Several weeks ago, during our conversation with Dr. Jim Swan, he mentioned that one of his latest consulting projects is the Victoria Caledonian Distillery in British Columbia. Graham McAloney is the driving force behind the project, which would be the third distillery on Vancouver Island, along with Shelter Point and Victoria Spirits. We sat down over breakfast a couple of weeks ago during the Victoria Whiskey Festival to catch up on his progress.
We called it Victoria Caledonian because we're doing a Scottish-style whiskey, so single malts. That's my passion. But I want to pick up the commercial branding of Scotch, single malts, but I want to honour the local milieu as well, because we're going to use BC barley, right? We've got BC water, etc. And so there's a connection, because Caledonian, as you probably know, and many of your listeners might know, was the name the Romans gave the Highlands of Scotland. But the local connection is the first Premier of BC wanted to call this New Caledonia. Of course, the Brits told them, no, you can't call it New Caledonia, you have to call it British Columbia. But so we're picking up Victoria for tourism and Caledonian too, as a nod back to Scotland, but picking up the local provenance as well.
I just want to clarify here, you do not have the traditional Canadian accent, so I would like to get something on your background as well, because you are from Scotland. Your background is in brewing, distilling, and chemistry, right?
Yes, originally from central Scotland, trained up to PhD level in fermentation. Had my first ever job actually was a summer student in the Black and White bottling factory just outside Glasgow. Had aspirations to work in brewing and distilling with all my academic credentials, but very traditional industry at that point, right? You know, we're talking 30 years ago, and ended up working in other types of fermentation with some great companies called Pfizer, the US multinational, Eli Lilly. But, you know, really quick tangent on that, there's a connection. When Eli Lilly wanted to scale up penicillin for the war effort, right? Penicillin, of course, being invented by a Scotsman, right? But the Americans helped commercialize it, of course. They couldn't figure out how to scale this up, and they had to do deep tank fermentation to get more penicillin out for the war effort. And who did they go to? Distillers Company Limited, who were doing deep tank fermentation. And so Dista Products, which is an Eli Lilly facility, came out of whiskey making and helped scale up modern biotech products, the first one being penicillin. So actually, in a sense, you know, there was that connectivity, but now I've come full circle back from pharma and biotech with all of that fermentation experience, and my passion has always been on the whiskey side, and so here's an opportunity to start up my own whiskey distillery here.
So you're going from prescription drugs to over-the-counter medication again?
The water of life, yes.
Tell me about the career change, because it had to be obviously a big one for you to make the move from a relatively safe career in the pharma industry to building your own distillery. I know you've been working on this for a few years.
Yeah, it's... You know, big corporate is a very comfortable environment, and there's a big infrastructure, deep pockets there. I'd moved on from pharma into biotech, which is much more entrepreneurial, and even helped found an angel investor investment network in Edmonton, Alberta, to help biotech companies get going, and I did some biotech stuff there too. So I got exposed to this whole startup company creation and financing area, and really developed my skill sets and experience there. So combining that with the corporate discipline of big corporate, the planning, delivering, implementation, it was an ideal combination to provide that platform to now come forward and do a whiskey business that is, you know, we want to do the best whiskies in terms of point of pride, turning out great, admired products, hopefully down the road, but with that business discipline that's going to allow you to succeed and have fun with those whiskies. And I say that because, you know, I was back in Scotland just a couple of months ago, networking with a whole bunch of great players, established players in Scotland in the whiskey industry there. And, you know, we've all got an ego. I put my ego aside for a few minutes and I asked these guys, look, here's our business plan. This is how we're going to implement. What am I doing right? What am I doing wrong? What can I do better? And, you know, some of the comments were, hey, look, there's 40 odd distilleries getting started up here. A few years, we think the majority of them may not exist, right? Or they'll be bought up by other people because they've failed financially. So for me, it's important, if we're going to have fun and create good whiskies, to have a solid business basis behind that. And so hopefully that's what I bring together with the passion for whiskey.
So how are you going to pull it off?
This might sound contrarian, but in my experience, the toughest aspect of starting a new business, any type of new business, is the money raising. And I had a lot of, and I've done this before, right? I've dealt with venture capitalists, aka vulture capitalists. I hope you're not being involved in that area. You can lose control of the agenda when you bring in institutional money. When you want to do a passion business like this, it's important to drive the right agenda. And so I took a contrarian approach, went across Canada with a prospectus to whiskey clubs, all the way from Halifax through Ontario, Alberta, British Columbia. And we got more than 200 whiskey enthusiasts to put their hard-earned cash into this business. Plus, of course, remortgaged my house. And we got actually some Canadian government support too. So that for me is the hardest part. Is raising that money. Any business, finding enough money to get you through to profitability, that's what will kill most companies in the first 5 years. That's the toughest part. The implementation, no less challenge, but that's the fun stuff, right? Is the implementation. I've done that kind of stuff before, and I'm going to have fun doing it.
It sounds an awful lot like you did everything you could to avoid a Balcones type situation in terms of bringing in additional investors. As we all know, Chip Tate essentially lost control of his distillery when his investors wound up with a majority stake and didn't like his plans. It sounds like you did everything possible to avoid that.
Yeah, I really feel for that chap because, you know, as an entrepreneur, founder, owner, you pour your heart and soul into this. And you put so much, you put your personal life on stake. You put your personal finances at stake. And you have a passion. And I think, you know, individuals like he and hopefully I, you know, you have not just the passion and the vision, but you do have the ability to implement. And that being able to have control of implementation of the vision, I think, is critical. If you have people coming in with big money and big egos without domain experience, it can be a nightmare situation. So I really feel for that Balcones situation.
So let's talk about the distillery now. Where's the status on construction? Is it done? Is it about to start? And when do you hope to start making spirit?
Patience is the key word here. I'm trying to build in quality from the get-go. That was what I learnt in big corporate. When you're doing any type of fermentation, it's quality is built in from the get-go. So our pot stills, Forsyth pot stills from Scotland, I do believe they make the best spirit for whiskey. Today, if you approach Forsyth, perhaps a 3-year lead time. Historically, it was perhaps only a 7 or 8 month lead time. Our lead time at the moment, we've been in discussions for a long time now, so we expect our pot stills to arrive about 12 to 14 months' time here in Victoria. And so within a couple of months, we'll be in a position to start making new make spirit at that point in time. Could I perhaps add about the other quality aspects? You know, the kind of...
Of course.
Thank you. So for me, you know, building this quality in from the get-go, you know, I've talked about the equipment. I've only got an academic industrial fermentation background. You know, I've not practiced whiskey distilling as an individual, right? But what I've learned through my career is you surround yourself with great people. And if you build quality, been there and done it, people into your venture, you're really going to help assure a quality spirit coming out.
I know one of those people is Jim Swann. I assume you were about to talk about him. And Jim, of course, mentioned your distillery on the show Christmas week as one of the projects he's working on for the future. So I wanted to make sure we talk about what you're working on with him, too. So I assume that's where you were going.
Yes, absolutely. So it's a small world. you know, it was funny, like Jim Swann, you have to be careful using superlatives, right? You know, you can sound overly promotional if you use too many superlatives. But, you know, in my view, Jim Swann is an absolute guru when it comes to whiskey maturation. And when you talk to people in the industry, he commands respect because of what he's accomplished, yeah? So, Jim, way back when, was the individual that suggested to Glen Morangy to try the port cask finish. Right, so you could argue, Balvenie might argue contrary, but you know that Glen, you know, because Glen Morangy sort of initiated that cask finishing concept, right, genre, that Jim was part of that, creating that whole new genre. You know, he's gone and helped Cavalan, you know, a single malt whiskey that came out of nowhere, out of Asia, and yet it's ranked in one of the top 20 best ever single malts on the planet, according to certain reviewers and writers. And he's helped Kilhoman and Penderin, etc. So he's had a tremendous track record of being there and done it, designing new whiskies, yeah? Getting access to wood, again, speaking to the quality component. You know, the old adage, the whiskey makes the wood, couldn't be truer, right? And so Jim brings that to the table as well, in terms of being able to help me source good Kentucky wood, Spanish bodega, you know, Portuguese port pipes, etc., wine cask, etc. He's got those network connections, and he's got the knowledge to make sure that we're getting good quality product as well. Funny little story is when I phoned up Jim and asked him if we would come on board, I thought I was going to interview him for a job, for a consultancy role. And his very polite and gentleman, old-style gentlemanly way, Jim interviewed me for an hour and a half. Basically saying, look, Graham, there's a lot of startup companies kicking around and, you know, they're not in it for the right reasons and they perhaps haven't structured it properly in terms of the objectives for great whiskey. tell me what you're doing, and I'll let you know if I'm able to come and join you, because I'll only work with one Canadian company. And so I want to make sure that I'm comfortable working with you. And it was a great, I loved that, right? And I love being able to share the vision with him. And yeah, at the end of it, he said, yes, I'm on board with you on that Canadian exclusive basis. So.
But I know you're bringing some of your own ideas to this too. I know you've hinted that you have some ideas for creating a young whiskey that works and for speeding up the maturation process yourself a little bit. And I'd like you to talk about that, because I know Jim has this gift for getting young whiskeys to market at an early age, as we've seen with Kilhoman and Cavalan and Penderin and the rest that he's worked with. What's your secret sauce, if you want to explain it, for getting the first whiskey to market within 3.5 to 4 years after you start making spirit?
That's a really tough question to answer.
That's why I asked it.
I would like to come back to the other key person we've got behind the whiskey making later, right? Accelerated maturation is quite controversial. In the past, the Scotch and Irish have prided themselves in age statements, and that's become a mark of quality, if you will. However, we've seen in recent years that there's been some spectacular young whiskies. Amaroot, 3, 4, 5 years old. Cavalan, 3, 4 years old. And they're ranked in the top 20 best ever single malts on the planet. So these days, age is not necessarily a proxy for great, complex, balanced single malt whiskies.
But let's point out real quickly, those are made in very hot, humid climates. I'm looking out the window here in Victoria, and it looks a hell of a lot like Scotland right now.
Yes. Yeah, in fact, today the rain was horizontal, so it was very like Scotland. There's a lot of things that contribute. I'm a scientist and an engineer, right? And I had a fascinating discussion with Jim. And Jim says, look, there's certain things you can't tell the public that we'll do, right? So I do apologize for those aspects. But, let's think about some of the things that do contribute, right? So I'll try to talk around it as opposed to specifically to some of the sensitive stuff, if you don't mind. If you look at the different approaches to bringing out a great complex young spirit, obviously the quality of the wood contact, right? I mean, you see that in something like, Lefroy Quarter Cask, right? It's fairly young whiskey, but it's got a lot more wood contact there, and it's a great balanced, Islay single malt. Quality wood contact will definitely bring on the whiskey faster, but balanced and complex. The cut on your spirit run. You wouldn't do this for all your styles, but if you want to have an approachable younger whiskey, do a bit of a narrower cut. Avoid some of those heavy congeners that have to be mellowed out through longer wood treatment, etc. Temperature, absolutely. You go back to chemistry 101. Chemical reactions that happen in a cask go exponentially with temperature. So in Kentucky, if you've got a cask up at the top of the warehouse and it's a lot warmer there, it comes on a lot faster. The distillers know that, right? Amaroot and Cavalan. Victoria is a milder climate than Scotland. And there is a tradition in Canada also of having temperature-controlled warehouses. I'm sure I've missed probably another couple of factors there that help create a young, complex, well-balanced, approachable spirit. But there's a bit of a sampling, if you will. I think the joy of whiskey is that as much as you might try and bring some science and engineering to assure quality and reproducibility, consistency, it's still an art. It's an artisanal game, right? And you'll never master the science behind it, and that's the beauty of it, right?
Now, you mentioned that you had another member of your team that should get some credit, right?
Yeah, so again, this with this principle of building the solid business foundation, surrounding yourself with great been there and done it experience, we've been very fortunate to bring on board Mike Nicholson. And I know you've interviewed Mike in the past, and he gave, I think, a very interesting, colourful discussion with you. Mike 18 different distilleries, single malt distilleries across Scotland when he worked with Diageo as a master distiller and distillery manager. And he's done pretty much every conceivable style of Scotch, all the way from Lagavulin, some people like to call it Lagavulin, but it's Lagavulin, all the way through to Speysides, Highlands, and down to Glenkinchie as a lowland. Now, for me, you know, Mike's got that distilling heart, you know, practice over decades. Yes, he's a third generation whiskey maker, right? It's in his genes. But for me as a businessman, what he brings is great experience with a wide variety of different styles, which we will aspire to putting out. He brings in manufacturing discipline. They've been there and done it, tried and tested with successful, great quality products, and making sure that we put out a consistent product, right? Because that's part of the secret. So that manufacturing discipline, if you will, and then of course a great nose, because you know another secret to a consistent product is you've got all these casks that are very unique, and there's always going to be this effort to do a marrying for your bottlings, and so what's critically important there is a knowledgeable, experienced nose to make sure you're putting out that well-balanced, complex spirit into the bottle.
We're sitting here over breakfast at the Hotel Grand Pacific in Victoria, and also at the table with us are Barbara and Bob Townsend of the Miner's Delight Inn in Atlantic City, Wyoming. And we don't often do this, but do you guys have any questions you want to ask?
No, but one thing that really struck me is we listen to your newscast all the time, Mark, and we listen to the interviews, and we appreciate it, but it's so fascinating to me to be able to watch an interview and to watch the interviewee's face and to see the passion and the joy that they're talking about, and that's been really fascinating, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Bob?
Well, thanks, Mark, and thanks. I really appreciate this being part of this interview. I wrote a note early on when you started asking your questions, Mark, a source for casks, and then you brilliantly must have read my note, or this was part of your spiel already. You talked about Jim Swan and his resources and the ability to get the wood, and I think that's becoming a more and more critical component of whiskey making nowadays with all the new distilleries coming online is, where's all the cask wood coming from? And thank you very much for responding to that. That's the only question I had. It's great to be a part of this. Thanks.
How hard is it going to be for you to source casks, Graham?
it's a concern. Thanks to George Washington and what he did for the Scotch and Irish and Canadian industry by, you know, dictating that there should be single use in bourbon.
I don't think it goes back that far, but...
That's been great, but of course, you know, with global sales booming, you know, $8 billion roughly, Scotch sales globally, Irish is it $1.5 billion or something now? Or?
Something
along those lines. So bourbon's doing great too, with over $1 billion, I think, in exports. But that means there's a lot of demand for bourbon wood, and as you know, it's the majority of the usage. But for me, it boils down to two things. It boils down to supply and demand, the basics, and being prepared to use your connections and your wallet book to get the best wood that you can. Jim Swan's key there, obviously. When I was back in Scotland, I took that question around as I was talking to some of the biggest and best distillers around there. And I even went to visit Speyside Cooperage. And Speyside Cooperage, they said, "Yeah, no, look, we'll assure you that we'll get you really good quality wood." So between Jim Swan and Speyside Cooperage, now Gordon McPhail, you've been there too. You had a great whiskey cast event from there. I asked them the same question, right? And they say the source through Speyside Cooperage, and they're very happy with the quality. And I don't think you get much better quality than Gordon McPhail wood, right? So I think, you know, there's ways to get the wood, but you have to be prepared to invest the time and effort to get good quality wood, and you're going to have to pull out the wallet book. So for me, as someone that's passionate about the whiskey, you don't let the accountants drive. With all due respect to that profession, right, you do not let the accountants drive the quality aspects of your business. And yes, wood's expensive in a total dollar sum, but when you amortize that over a high-quality whiskey, I think it's well worth it.
You're talking about not letting the accountants drive the business, but as a small entrepreneurial business, I'm sure that... those accountants are also relatives. What did your family say when you decided that I'm going to give up that safe pharma career and we're going to build a distillery?
Suffice it to say, I've got a very long-suffering wife, a very understanding wife. Also, the family back in Scotland, they came out of the catering trade, and I see my roots. A quick digression to put a bit of colour onto it. I come from a working class environment in Scotland. The whole raison d'etre for the village, the small town we lived in, was a steelworks. Very hard life in Scotland, and with the modern economy that went by the wayside, lots of unemployment. And I was expected to grow up and go to the steelworks just like my other brothers did, my father, grandfather, etc. before them. But I think there's something that Scotland perhaps has in common with North America. And there was a poet called Robert Burns coined the phrase a lad of parts, or a lad of parts. And a lad of parts means it's someone that can come from that meek background, right? But you go out and you get yourself an education and it opens doors. And then you can really aspire to do something. And so my oldest brother, kind of in a sense, was the example of that. Expected to go into the steelworks, he turned around to his parents, my mum and dad, and said, "I want to be a chef." They must have thought he was soft in the head, right? That was beyond the ken, the knowledge, the experience of a working class Scottish family. But they supported him. He trained in a 5-star hotel and he's got a highly successful restaurant and now a wedding function suite, etc. And he's provided good business experience and guidance for me. In terms of, you know, the idea of choosing Victoria as a location for high tourism, because you're going to bring in a lot of tourists as well as whiskey enthusiasts who become brand ambassadors with a great experience and talk about your whiskey, talk about the great tour that they have. So that's been very, you know, from a family perspective, that's had a big impact on me. And I continue to rely on that type of experience. My wife, we had to, it was a negotiation. We had to remortgage the house, right? For the 3 years of best practices research that I did, that was all unsalaried, right? A year and a half of financing that I put into it, it was all unsalaried. We've racked up our mortgage big time, right? So it's a classic entrepreneurial story. There's a lot on the table here. And thank goodness my wife is understanding of that.
And how soon before it starts to pay off?
Again, going back to Robbie Burns, the poet laureate of Scotland, the great saying there is, the best laid plans of mice and men, gang after glee is the second part of it, which means they often go wrong. So you can put the best plan together, and any angel investor or entrepreneur will tell you this, you'll put the best research plan together, you'll surround yourself with great people, but the outcomes, the implementation, will never be what you totally expect, right? And you have to be flexible and adjust to it. So there's no genuine hard prediction of when we'll get cash flow positive, but we build in hopefully the best practices that are hopefully accelerated maturation of a great quality, hopefully award-winning and respected spirit, that really helps the situation. The recognition that when you're, some people may think this is an anathema, but technically speaking, whiskey is just unhopped beer that gets distilled twice, speaking as an engineer, not as a connoisseur.
Whiskey is what beer wants to be when it grows up.
Yeah, very good. Absolutely. And so we will actually be operating a microbrewery out of the same plant, right? And when I took that thought around Scotland, they were, fantastic idea. And here in British Columbia, I think as in North America generally, the craft beer sector is grabbing massive market share from the multinationals. Here in British Columbia alone, revenues grew 25% year on year last year, on average. And that's people that don't have a lot of business acumen, some of them. The good guys here in BC, Phillips, Driftwood, they grew 100% last year in revenue. It's an instant product. The fresher it is, so it's almost the opposite of whiskey. You're investing a lot of cash capital into working capital into something that sits in a warehouse for a long time without any return. But beer, You invest that money and the next day you're selling it almost, right, by comparison. So it makes a very good business complement. And then you think about the beer drinkers. I'm passionate about converting people to whiskey. There's so many people don't realise how spectacular whiskey is. There has to be so many beer drinkers out there that we can pull in for tours of a microbrewery that we'll hit them with the whiskey as well and educate them. There's a whiskey for every drinker out there, right? And I think we can convert a lot of people to whiskey as well, but through that approach.
And it's better than all the other guys that are doing vodkas and gins and wind up doing that to the exclusion of whiskey because they spend all their money on the vodka and gin and can't put any money into whiskey.
I agree with that, you know, from whiskey sort of connoisseur's perspective, right? And you as a purist that you want to be able to aspire to that and do that. However, I respect the situation of a lot of these startup distillers because of exactly what you're saying. It's a cash flow issue, right? A majority of these small startups will go out of business if they don't generate cash quickly. And so I think you have to consider the possibility of doing vodkas and gins. For me, I've kind of angst over that because, you know, I want to build a reputation for whiskey, right? And the commercial perspective, you know, the branding around the whiskey, right? Be recognized as a great whiskey company ultimately. And so you don't want to dilute that message by putting out the white spirits. So yeah, I'm mulling over whether or not to do the gin aspect because gin's a big complex drink as well. Vodka, I'm sorry, I just, you know, for me, a great vodka is a flavorless alcohol, and then they bring in all these extra flavors that are artificially added. I'm sorry, I hope I don't offend a lot of people here, but I can't buy into vodka.
Well, I agree with you on the need to raise the cash flow, but a lot of these guys that are doing the vodka and gin, they spend all their resources getting the raw materials and the time to make the vodka and gin, and then have a hard time devoting time on the still to making whiskey because they need the cash flow. But if you can obviously use the same mash tuns and the fermenters to make beer, you're not running that still all the time making vodka and gin, and you can make beer just as easily. So it makes a lot more sense, and there are a lot more beer drinkers out there than there are vodka and gin drinkers.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I do appreciate your perspective on that. And that certainly has, you know, it's what our team have come to the conclusion of, and it's certainly the feedback we had when I went back through Scotland. You know, a lot of them said, you know, hey, a great idea, I wish I'd thought about that. But in reality, I don't think there's any new ideas on this planet. There's always an entrepreneur somewhere has put that together. You know, within the local context, hopefully we're approaching it the right way, but time will tell.
I didn't ask earlier, where's the distillery going to be located? Do you already have the real estate set up and everything?
So this is where, you know, if I was in big corporate, I'd be having nightmares at the moment. But because I'm an entrepreneur and entrepreneurs take risks and are used to juggling multiple balls and being a jack of all trades, you've got a high tolerance for progressing multiple agendas in parallel.
You don't have a place yet, do you?
So the scuttlebuck on that is we're going to be in, the target is downtown Victoria, right? Because there's a tourism piece that we alluded to, right? This has to be a big building because I want to have large numbers of tourists, ultimately brand ambassadors, converts to whiskey coming through there. So 20,000 square foot building, downtown Victoria, there's a limited number of options. The one we're pursuing presently is called the Crystal Garden, which used to be a Victorian era swimming pool, the biggest saltwater swimming pool in the British Empire. It's right behind the famous Empress Hotel and, I don't know, 100 yards from this great Victoria Whiskey Festival. So great location. We're talking to City Council at the moment in terms of trying to negotiate access to that iconic heritage building, which I think would fit with a great iconic heritage spirit.
Graham is optimistic, but note that he used the word heritage building. Crystal Gardens is on the Canadian Register of Historic Places, and while Graham is working with Victoria City officials, the Heritage Branch of British Columbia's provincial government would have to sign off on any changes to the building. We'll keep you posted. That's this week's Whiskey Cast In Depth, brought to you by Makers 46, inventively finished and meticulously handmade to unlock big, complex flavors. Makers 46 is the bold side of Makers. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is brought to you by Ben Romack, Let's start off with one of Eddie Russell's creations at Wild Turkey, the second release of Forgiven. The original was created accidentally a couple of years ago when workers at the distillery pumped a bunch of rye whiskey into a tank full of bourbon. The result was around 60% bourbon, 40% rye, and it turned out pretty good. So good that it sold out within a few months. Eddie Russell went back and tweaked the mix a bit with slightly different bourbons and ryes to create batch number 302 of Forgiven, which is bottled at 45.5% ABV. The nose is honey sweet with touches of fudge, caramel ice cream topping, vanilla, and a hint of oakiness. The taste starts off sweet, then turns spicy with cinnamon, black pepper, and a touch of clove. The sweetness comes back as the spices fade with honey, fudge, and vanilla notes. The finish is long and smooth with lingering spices and hints of honey and dark chocolate. Personally, I think it's even better than the original, and I'm scoring Wild Turkey Forgiven, batch number 302, a 93. A few weeks ago, I mentioned Ranger Creek's first straight bourbon release, the 36 caliber single barrel. It's a limited edition bourbon aged for 3 years and 8 months at the distillery in San Antonio, Texas. Received a sample recently. It's bottled at 48% ABV. The nose has a good balance of oak, molasses, brown sugar, vanilla, wet leather, a hint of allspice, and a nice honey sweetness that comes out with time. The taste has good spicy notes of chili powder, black pepper, and a hint of cinnamon. They fade to reveal honey, vanilla, a hint of peaches, oak, and tobacco notes. The finish is mouth-watering, long, and spicy. I'm scoring Ranger Creek's 36 caliber single barrel an 88. Earlier in the news, I mentioned a bunch of new Glendronic single cask releases. I had the chance to go back and taste some of the Glendronic Core Range single malts while I was in Victoria recently. The Allardyce 18-year-old is matured in Oloroso sherry casks and bottled at 48% ABV. The nose is fruity with cooked apples, peaches, and pears, hints of figs and toffee, brown sugar, and honey. The taste is thick, mouth-puckering, and fruity with Christmas cake, honey, toffee, orange oils, and hints of clove and cinnamon. The finish is long and dry with a good balance of dried fruits, soft spices, and a nice warming touch. I'm scoring the Glendronic Allardyce a 94. Several years ago, I met Christophe Dupic, who makes single malts at his family's distillery in the Lorraine region of France under the G. Roselliers brand name. Those whiskeys are now available in Canada, and I brought a sample of the G. Roselliers Fumé Collection single malt home from Victoria. It's a lightly peated malt matured for 8 years in Fino sherry casks and bottled at 46% ABV. The nose has a good balance of soft peat, red grapes, plums, and baked apples with soft spices and a hint of oak. The taste is fruity and well-rounded with a good balance of white pepper, a soft peatiness, red apples and grapes, and a touch of mintiness in the background. The finish is subtle and dry with a fruity tartness and a hint of white pepper. I'm scoring the G. Roselliers Fumé Collection an 87. The What I'm Tasting This Week department is proudly brought to you by Benromic, the classic Speyside single malt whiskey, handcrafted slowly, the time-honored way. Discover more at benromic.com. Now, I've added these tasting notes to the searchable list of 1,400 different whiskeys from around the world at whiskeycast.com. That's also where you'll find links for WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, the latest whiskey news and events, details on our charity print to benefit the Spey Foundation, and much more, including a complete archive of past episodes. You can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and even Google Plus at WhiskeyCast. And my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2015, and comes to you each week from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.